This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Paul Lord Bewe. Lord Bewe is a member of the British House of Lords, who is also Emeritus Professor of Irish Politics in Queen's University, Belfast. He is the author of numerous books and articles dealing with modern Irish history. And today we're discussing his newest book, Ancestral Voices in Irish Politics, Judging Dillon and Parnell, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Lord Bewe.
Thank you for having me, Charles. It's a pleasure.
Lord Bewe, what is the thesis of your book?
My book is really a meditation on ancestral loyalties and their role in Irish history. Parnell, a great nationalist leader, came from a Protestant background. Dillon from the very upper end of the Catholic upper middle class bourgeoisie. And both of them had very different family traditions, very different instinctive worldviews. And I'm really intrigued by the interaction between these two figures. I should say Parnell was the leading figure in Irish nationalism, hugely famous, by the way, in Irish America in the 1880s, and one of the best known people, you know, outside Irish America from this side of the world, in New York in particular. And Dillon, too, spent a lot of time in America, and indeed his father had worked there as a barrister. So there is a strong American dimension to both these people. And in fact, Parnell's mother was American as well.
Given the fact that Parnell's father was uninterested in politics and the family fortunes were uncertain at best, why did Parnell choose to go into politics?
An earlier Parnell biographer, Robert Key, just gives a one-word answer: boredom. And there is a little bit of that. He has achieved by that stage in his life, born in 1846, goes into politics, what gets elected 1875, so you're talking to the 30. And he's not done very much. He went to America, did find that he was just treated as a nonentity, whereas he regarded the Parnell family he came from in Wicklow as a big deal. commanding respect. And while his father wasn't interested in politics, his ancestors had been very active in politics and major figures in Anglo-Irish relations. So he felt he was the bearer of a family name, which was just about cashable in Irish politics, just about recognisable. And he had just about enough money to pay for his own campaign, just about to get into Parliament. So he decides to achieve some note. Having achieved note, for example, at Cambridge University, he's rusticated, leaves without a degree. Not so uncommon in those days, but nonetheless, no particular excellence, no particular evidence of any achievement. Quite a good cricketer, like his father, but really drifting. And he goes to the nationalist cause, which is growing, but not so strongly, but probably the wise move to get elected as an MP. No particular name recognition at first or enthusiasm. Turnout's quite low when he gets elected. But from 1875, 1876, he starts to become and is for 14 years a central figure in the Parliament. I now work in the United Kingdom Parliament. And his ghosts, he haunts the corridor. Many portraits outside the main dining room in the Commons, the Strangers' Dining Room in the House of Commons. There's a large portrait called The Men Who Made Home Rule, and Parnell is at the centre of it and a load of his allies sitting around him. So he became a superstar in politics, name recognition very high, and when he visited America in 1800, 62 cities I think he visited, and Dylan was with him a large part of that time, and Dylan was also well recognized in America. Both of them were actually matinee idol politicians, both of them extremely good looking, but Parnell was the one who had the extra edge of acclaim, excitement in that period in the 1880s.
In the case of Dylan, would it be true to say that the choice of political career was overdetermined by family background?
Yes, his father had been involved in the 1848 Young Ireland Rising, had then gone to America as that rising crumbles, and reconstructs himself as quite a successful barrister in the law courts in America, doing rather well. The English newspapers comment in the 1850s on how well young Dylan, the former revolutionary, is doing as a lawyer in America. His father was educated at Trinity College Dublin, which is very unusual for a Catholic at that time, a Protestant elite institution. Dylan, in fact, always was an enemy, really, of Trinity College Dublin on those grounds. But his own father was actually educated there. And they do come from a very well-off family. And there are some suggestions in the family history that it may have been that Dylan himself, the money comes from the fact that somewhere along the line, long before Dylan was born, there was actually some alliance with some local landlord, and some of the Dylan money comes from, some alliance of some sort, semi-matrimonial. But certainly by the 1840s, Dylan is at university in Dublin. His father is one of the John Dylan Sr., John Blake Dylan, is one of the senior revolutionaries. And some of the revolutionaries emerged from that failed revolution with their reputations in tatters. John Blake Dylan didn't. He eventually returns to Ireland, leaves what would have been a good career in law in New York, comes back to Ireland and is elected as a Catholic liberal, but not particularly nationalist MP. And the Dylan family are key. If you're interested in the question of how might serious Catholics, Irish Catholics in particular, and of course this was the big issue with the Kennedy family when JFK was elected, how do you engage in the wider politics in a non-Catholic state? The Dylan family are early practitioners of the struggle between liberal ideals, Catholic ideals, nationalist ideals.
What do you mean when you refer to, quote, Parnell's imagined community of a new Ireland, unquote?
Well, I say in my book, and it's been a feature, I've written a lot about Parnell over the years, what is new in this latest book, which I owe to some other scholars, like Professor Jed Martin, is a sense of Parnell's material interest and interest in the economy. And I think that we've tended, including myself as historians, to think about him as a political nationalist, that sort of figure, and have ignored the fact that he actually was deeply committed to the material development of Ireland. He'd be delighted by the wealth of contemporary Ireland, although somewhat disappointed by the fact that for the first 80 years or 70 years, certainly, of Irish independence, there was no sign of anything rather than Ireland being poorer that rather than richer. But he would nonetheless be delighted by the new Ireland. So the imagined community has got this material economic success dimension in his eye. But there is also something else, which is that he did believe in reconciliation with his own people, the Protestant Irish, even with the deeply unfashionable Protestant democracy in the North. But he does make it clear in his last speeches, in what's called the fatal drag speech, that until there is reconciliation between the Protestants of the North and the broad Catholic nationalists of the island as a whole, Ireland will never enjoy perfect freedom. And this is a theme that John Hume picked up on in more recent times during the Troubles. And that particular speech, when he was engaging in a dialogue with the IRA leadership, that particular speech is quoted by Hume saying, this is the way forward, not violence. The way to achieve a united Ireland is through reconciliation and persuasion. So that's what I mean by Parnell's imagined community. It's that sort of an Ireland. As I say, the economic dimension in it is stronger than I realized for a long time. And his involvement in various schemes, mining in Arklow and so on, these economic enterprises he was involved in are really more important than I first realized.
Who was John Mitchell, and why did he have such an important role in your narrative?
Mitchell is very important because, quite frankly, he's the Irish nationalist who is read the most in the 19th century. You can read all these clever liberal historians writing about Ireland, some very high-quality stuff in the 19th century. It doesn't matter. In fact, two of them once met said, it doesn't matter, we might as well have saved our breath, because John Mitchell is in every cabin in Ireland. Every IRA man, when it came to 1918 to 21, read Mitchell. And Mitchell is straight brutal themes. He was, by the way, John Dillon, who did not follow Mitchell's reasoning in these matters, but the two of them were allies in the 1848 revolutionary, and they were friends at that time. But John Mitchell, who is actually from an Ulster Presbyterian background, milder Irish nationalists used to say that's why he knew how to curse so well. But he basically argues that the famine is not just a failure of economic public policy, it's deliberate genocide. That Britain's intentions with respect to Ireland are always aggressive and to grind it down. And that is the argument of his various books. And You Cannot Forgive, which, of course, to a lot of Irish Americans in the 19th century seemed not an unreasonable argument, even though Irish Americans increasingly did very well in America and did well partly because they were a big, strong people and partly because, unlike other immigrants who came from Europe, they had the English language as soon as they got off the boat. But nonetheless, there was obviously a lot of quite understandable historic resentment over the famine. But Mitchell doesn't say, it's a British double standard. They said, we're going to have a union of Ireland and Britain, everybody's going to be prosperous. And then they let a million people die. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say that this or that policy by Britain. They had soup kitchens for a year, which kept a lot of people alive. And then famine fatigue set in, compassion set in London, and people stopped paying out the amount of money that was paid out in the early years of the famine. He says this is deliberate genocide for many Irish nationalists in the 20th century on a par with Hitler and the Jews. In fact, it's very hard to argue that. There is no industrial machine of killing set up of the Irish. But it is very easy to argue that the active union of 1800 was based on the idea that Ireland would now be more prosperous and enjoy equality. And the loss of life during the famine, a disaster in the sense coming from, the potato crop failing, which is not anything that Britain did. And also an awful lot of people die from famine fever. And we've seen with COVID, a modern state has difficulty with contagious fevers and keeping people alive. But it doesn't matter. It's not an argument that the Union failed by its own standards, which is a perfectly fair argument, one the Parliament would have agreed with. It's an argument that this is deliberate, intense genocide. And everything that Britain does with respect to Ireland is governed by a genocidal intent. Now, as liberal British public opinion becomes more and more liberal in the 19th century, this becomes a kind of absurd argument. But Mitchell never changed. Parnell himself never believed in it. He believed he was very sensitive to the liberalisation of British public opinion and the desire of many British politicians, most obviously Gladstone, to make recompense to Ireland. But Mitchell never accepted it. The problem for Parnell and Dillon, and Dillon's brother wrote a major biography in Colorado, actually, but of Mitchell, was to how did you disconnect? Dillon was extremely close, was a pallbearer at Mitchell's funeral. Parnell gave money to Mitchell's last parliamentary campaign. Everybody agrees he's a great hero. There's another problem, by the way. He's a fanatical supporter of slavery. He fights for the South. His son Lucy, he's a plantation when he comes, and he's a fanatical supporter of slavery. That there is still a statue up to him, which doesn't mention this, in Newry in Ireland. So there's another problem, which Parnell, who, for example, all his connections with his mother's family were on the northern side in the Civil War, would most certainly not have been, and nor, frankly, was Dillon, and nor, to be fair to Irish nationalists as a whole, they were not supporters of slavery. But Mitchell was the exception, which proved the rule. This is a man of absolutely forthright opinions. And for example, Britain is a liberal, cosmopolitan empire, capitalist empire, and that's why it supports the North against the South, etc. He's a man of very rigid, clear-cut thinking, and it was on the same ferocity with which he argued the British policy in Ireland was genocide, was argued in favour of slavery, where some of the things he says are actually terrifying, and in favour of physical violence against slaves. But on the Irish side of the argument, he had huge influence. So you had to kind of creep away from his influence, which was very much there in the young Parnell and the young Dillon. They did creep away. And you could see, if you look carefully at Parnell's speeches, you'll say things like, I know John Mitchell always believed this, and maybe he was right, but I can't quite follow him on this. You could see clearly the way in which they creep away from the shadow of Mitchell, because it's too brutal and it's too unrealistic. When you've got one of the major British governing parties in the 1880s saying, let's give Ireland self-government, it's a bit ludicrous to pretend that Mitchell's view that it's all about oppressing Ireland in British politics, and that's the one unchanging principle. It's almost impossible to sustain it. So they creep away from his position. Dillon's brother, William Dillon, does acknowledge the problem of slavery, but just kind of says, well, most of us didn't agree with him about that. That would be true.
Why was the Catholic diaspora in the United States such an important element in the Irish politics in the period covered by your book?
Why was the
Irish Catholic diaspora in the United States such an important element in the politics covered by your book?
It's coming into its own in terms of self-importance. I mentioned earlier, it's remarkably quickly how people, if you look at the Five Points in New York and so on, and look at people coming off those what were called coffin ships, they weren't actually, they were in that simple sense. There was usually somebody like Lord Palmerston, who thought his land was overpopulated, sent money to people to go to America, but doing their instructions. So, for example, everybody gets some whiskey on a Sunday night to the captain, etc. In other words, conditions were not as heartless as they made out to be, but they're tough. But these people get up and they adapt very quickly to America. But the first few years, it's a question of adapting, surviving, getting into town halls, getting into the police service in New York, Boston, getting into the post offices, all the other work, building political structures with Tammany Hall, which gave the Irish a foothold in an early welfare state in the great cities and Chicago as well. So this is the work of the first 20 or so years after the famine. Then this moment comes. Nobody's quite aware. But suddenly the Irish are they're going beyond that now. They're getting better jobs. They've got political power. They're not struggling for it. And that's the moment when Parnell comes to gain money for his cause in 1880. And it's just a moment of timing. Even 5 years before, the Home Rule Party approaches the American Congress and says, we'd like you to send a message in favor of Ireland to London, and the powers that be in Washington forget about it, don't care. 5 years later, Parnell is speaking a very rare thing in those days to Congress. It's just the tipping point when suddenly Irish America moves from survival mode to success mode. And a lot of what goes on, and there's a brilliant book by Professor Thomas N. Briner, a Boston scholar, saying this, a lot of what's happening isn't so much about Ireland, it's about the self-esteem owed to us as citizens of the great American Republic. And that you will listen to, and other people will listen to our complaints, because it's a way of acknowledging that we've arrived. And it's very understandable. It is, after all, a great success story, Irish America.
Why, as you put it, was, quote, the British liberal intelligentsia impressed by Parnell, unquote?
Well, part of it is the style that he's got an English accent, because he was at school in England. And the crucial thing is your period of schooling. He does not have an Irish accent. His mother is American Protestant, from a distinguished American senior naval background, and his father an Irish Protestant. He has a Cambridge education and style. So there is no sense in whatsoever in which, when he stands up in Parliament, the feeling that this is some paddy just doesn't exist. And that, you know, I mean, I think the Irish people exaggerated all times English anti-Irishness. That having been said, it does exist in places. The parliamentary party, the Irish party in this period, as I point out in my book, and even after Parnell's death, they were in Parliament, they were an important and accepted part of Parliament. But, for example, they didn't dress for dinner. They ate in the parliamentary building because it was usually cheaper. They ate together in regular daytime clothes. The average other MPs would actually dress for dinner and would be eating in more expensive restaurants around the place and better places. They just were a bit of a cast apart. Now, the one person who is clearly a gentleman, just like us, is Parnell, and his reading and his habits, his English mistress, all of this is very, and he lived the last 10 years of his life. He was living mainly in Eltham and Kent, in the house that his mistress had, and very rarely went to Ireland in the last several years of his life. So, you know, he looked like one of us, and he wasn't a particularly good speaker, but he wasn't bad. And they also, the older Parnell got, the more the latent conservatism of being a landlord's son emerged in his being. And Dillon continued throughout the 1880s to be more and more radical in his hatred for the landlord class. Well, the older Parnell got, the more he felt they'd been beaten. They've lost the land war. Now, we still need people like that in Ireland. They can contribute to local businesses. They can contribute to the localities in which they live in, as my family does, as one of the more popular landed families. Big liberal tradition of the Parnell family, always been, for example, for Catholic emancipation in the early years of the century when that was not a fashionable cause. So So the Parnells always had a certain grau, as they say in Irish, or welcome in Wicklow. But his view was, if my family could do it, why not the rest of them? And it'll be a better place, more variety in the gene pool, so to speak. I'm sure he thought like that. More variety in the gene. He was very, very interested in science, by the way. I read widely. So Parnell, you know, was recognizably one of us in Westminster. And but the fact that the undertow, having led an agrarian revolution, that he clearly now wanted to switch it off, that in turn increases your fan base in the Westminster Parliament.
Why were Parnell and what were Parnell and Dillon's attitudes toward the so-called three Fs?
Well, the three Fs are fixative self, freedom of tenure, freedom of eviction, fixity of tenure, fixity of tenure, free sale. Right now, these are all the what is they're all supposed to be embodied in the in Gladstone's Land Act. Although, funnily enough, Gladstone did not believe he'd gone quite so far, because he believed so much in traditional political economy, he didn't believe he could actually have conceded fixity of tenure in the real world, as opposed to landlords having the right to evict. In the real world, the right to evict basically is not gone entirely, gone 95% in that Land Act. And one of the things is British politicians are making these huge concessions, tearing up their normal view about the market economy, is something they can only do by deceiving themselves about what they've done. Now, Gladstone, you know, deceived himself. Parnell didn't. He knew that the 1881 Land Act, which basically, to put this very simply, led to a 20% rent reduction all round in Ireland, was a win for the peasants and a defeat for the landlords. Didn't mean the landlords were gone that year, but they would certainly be gone within 20 years, 25 years. And this is what, in most cases. And that's what Parnell knew. Now, Parnell's view was, okay, we won. Now let's get the money out of the British Treasury to bridge the gap between what the landlords can afford to sell their land at, but stay in the village, and perform, still perform a useful social role. Let's see if we can do that. And actually, in 1903, that's what the British government decided to do. And if Parnell hadn't died young from Bright's disease at the age of 46, he would have been 64. He would actually have lived to see his ideal of the solution of the Irish land question, therefore leading to greater social harmony. Buy the landlords out, the Treasury subsidizes the process, the peasants come to own their own land, and the landlords can have enough money to stay behind and perform a leadership role on local government, etc., etc. That's what, and probably he wants them to more of the greater nationalist politics like himself. All these things he says unambiguously. It's that undercurrent of conservatism in his makeup, which is even there in the most revolutionary moments, but certainly in the last 8 or 9 years of his life, as he gets older, is really, really explicit. That's why so many English MPs, including conservatives like Churchill's father, Randolph Churchill, really, really admired him.
And what was Dillon's attitude towards the so-called three Fs?
Well, Dillon's attitude was, this is not enough. This is something, instead of getting rid of the landlords immediately, it's just maybe a slow death, but I don't want a slow death. I want them gone tomorrow or yesterday, we would say. And Dillon's attitude over the next 4 or 5, first of all, he retires from the Irish Parliamentary Party. He goes to join his brother in Colorado, and on a ranch in Colorado, and he stays there for about a year and a year and a half, then gets a bit bored, I suspect, and knows he's still got the name and the rep to go back into Dublin politics. And he reappears in 1885 and says, I'm back. Hey, I'm back. And Parnell says, oh, yeah, fine. I know you walked out on me, but I forgive you. Come and join the ranks, and sets him up with a seat in Tipperary. That's why Parnell is so bitter when in the divorce crisis and the comes about, and the fact that Parnell was living with a married woman for several years, when that comes about, something Dylan knew, by the way, the whole time, from the very earliest part of that relationship. But when the divorce crisis comes about, Dylan turns on Parnell and takes the Catholic Church line that this is outrageous and shocking, and indeed the British liberal nonconformist line, and you must go as leader. And Parnell took the view, which you would do in Parnell's position, which is actually you walked out in a difficult moment. You wouldn't accept a compromise that was right to accept and flounced off to America. And I let you back in when you came back to Dublin. You owe me. That was Parnell's view. Not unreasonable either. Not, you can understand why he felt it. And with Dylan, there were never really... I mean, look, there was a basic difference, both in some ways. Both of them had been at one stage rather quite good mathematicians at university. Both of them bright enough. When Parnell first came to America, Dylan was supposed to act as his secretary. First of all, Dylan was like a lot of bright, bookish people, extremely bookish, entirely sloppy about his personal life, was always leaving his slippers in every hotel all over America and having new slippers the whole time. But he couldn't really run Parnell's appointments either. And it's not just temperament of Dylan as an upper middle class spoilt boy, which he was, and his family had important business interests in Ireland by this time and so on. He's probably better off than Parnell, but he couldn't work, you know, be the kind of dairy manservant for this Protestant leader. And he's eventually replaced by Tim Healy, who was equally bright but poor, and therefore glad to have the job of doing Parnell's dairy, etc. But there is a thing just always in Dylan that I'm really as grand a person as you, Parnell. My father was a great revolutionary. My father was a great lawyer. My father was a long-time MP, etc. You are, you know, some Anglo-Irish remnant, yes. From the 1790s to the 1830s, your family was important, but mine is more important in more recent times, and certainly getting richer all the time. This is the story of upward Catholic mobility in 19th century Ireland. And so that is important. And also, I have to say, Dylan was a serious Catholic. You have to say these things. Modern Ireland has so left Catholicism behind so quickly. Although the referendum defeat on Sunday suggests perhaps a little bit, perhaps not as quickly as the political classes thought. You have to say this, that Dylan was a person who took his religion very, very seriously indeed.
How did Gladstone's newly elected government in 1880 endeavor to conciliate the Irish, and how did Parnell and Dylan respond to such conciliation?
Well, initially, the Gladstone government came in. There was a land agitation already afoot in Ireland, in most counties, but by no means all. And also, by the way, very much in the west of Ireland among the poorer tenant farmers. And by the way, at the end of this agitation, the reforms that are won are not enough to stop people saying, next stop, New York. So if you're a poor farmer in the West, this is the last fling for a certain type of rural economy. And then after it's over, 1882, 1886, these poorer counties, people go to, I mean, they flood off to New York. It's the last fling. And they're probably, in the end, their descendants are much richer because of that decision. But the reaction of the Liberal government is, yeah, a moderate reform here, a thing called the Compensation for Disturbance Bill, which basically makes the eviction of small farmers much harder and reduces one of the weapons that the landlords had against the Irish land, against the land war. It also meant that if you had money to pay lawyers, and hard-working Americans certainly provided dollars to pay the lawyers in Ireland, you could fight all over the land courts. And there were some lawyers who made an absolute fortune in this period. So the first reaction was a thing called a Compensation for Disturbance Bill, which was artfully designed to make the agitation worse. Because A, it didn't pass because the House of Lords wouldn't pass it, and B, in those days the House of Lords could do what I can't do today, which is we can delay parliamentary legislation for a while, but we cannot stop it. And it's only significant, therefore, in those moments in history when delay of a few weeks is important. But the House of Lords said no in August 1880. And it also said no, and also people noted that the counties which were going to be given this reform of compensation for disturbance, which was basically to make it almost impossible to evict anybody who was a small farmer, were the counties of Ireland which had been agitating. Now, most of them hadn't been. A large minority had. The western counties had, the poorest had. Now the stronger, wealthier farmers, I look back at my own family, the Catholic farmers become involved because they can see this is ridiculous. There's going to be a reform here, and you don't get included in the legislation unless you've been agitating in your locality. So the Liberal government's first attempt at moderate reform was a massive disaster. It didn't get passed and was a stimulus to further agitation. And the stronger farmers suddenly become involved. Farmers who have plenty of money, who's sending their children to convents, whose sons are going to be priests and bishops, they all now become involved in this campaign. Not people who are trying to get by on 15 acres of rock and bad quality grass in County Mayo or Galway. And the whole of Ireland, Ireland has some of the best land in Europe. This is the complexity of Ireland. The wealthier farmers became involved. It became a national movement. And the 1881 Land Act, as I was saying earlier, simple translation, 20% rent reduction all around. Now, if you're a well-off Catholic farmer, as my ancestors were, that's very handy. That's if you're paying £400 of rent a year, you're now paying, 20% less. If you're trying to survive on a rock, paying £15 a year, it's no use at all. You just can't get by. That's why the 1881 Land Act is broadly a victory for Irish farmers, but more especially the stronger farmers, and the weaker farmers flood off to America again in a new flood out of the Irish ports into New York City. And it's a real turning point. But that's why we could say, I use the phrase in my book, it's actually from Sergeant O'Sullivan, who was part of the political class in Dublin at the time, describes Parnell as the hero of the bourgeoisie. And that's what he was. He was the hero of the bourgeoisie, not so much the small tenant farmers. And if you were Dylan, you would say, those are the people I really cared about most. But that's the reality. That's how the movement then collapsed. Either you have that type of compromise or you have a full-scale revolution, and Ireland didn't have the arms, the weapons, or the means to have a full-scale revolution, and Parnell certainly didn't want to have one, or you settle for that type of big popular victory, and then the establishment in reward to Parnell, 85 MPs elected from Ireland. Nobody could get elected for a seat where there is a majority of Catholics in Ireland, and I mean 18 of them are not, but 85 unless they support Parnell. His name is the winning ticket, and he becomes enormously famous. He never actually goes back to America after 1880, but he's hugely famous in the States. And his mother is living there a lot of the time, so she periodically gives interviews in her home in New Jersey, etc., just to remind people about her wonderful son Charles.
How did Parnell and Dillon react to the Phoenix Park murders of 1882?
Well, they both reacted with horror, but here is the paradox. Those murders, they were closer to the perpetrators than it became polite for anybody to admit. They were paid for by a man called Patrick Egan, who was the treasurer of the Land League. A treasurer of the Home Rule movement was a man called Frank Byrne, and the secretary was a man called Thomas Brennan. All three were heavily involved in paying for the group of assassins. The weapons were brought in from England by Frank Byrne's wife. All these people fled to America immediately. Egan, with the money, was a successful businessman in Dublin in the first place, made more money in America, and ended up as he was a U.S. ambassador in Chile during the Batsiamaga coup in, I think, the late 1890s. They all reconstructed themselves in Frank Burns' funeral in 1894 is a huge Irish-American turnout. But these are the people who paid, there's no doubt about this really, who paid the assassins, provided the weapons, and so on. And one of the intermediaries is a man called Patrick Sheridan. It's the same Sheridan family, Martin Sheridan, famous, I think, athlete, New York policeman, athlete in the next generation at the Olympics. P.J. Sheridan is another. They are all part of the revolutionary wing of the Land League, and they all flee. They all have to flee to America. It's one reason why it was easier for Parnell to shift the Home Rule movement along more moderate parliamentary lines, because the revolutionary elites have bunked off. But I mentioned to you earlier the Odyssey of Life. The Strangers Gallery has this portrait of Parnell and the men who made Home Rule. Frank Byrne is there, Patrick Egan is there, I think Thomas Brennan is there. Three of the authors of the most famous British political assassination of a member of Parliament in the 19th century, in May 1882 in Dublin. Three of them are sitting on the wall outside the parliamentary dining room. Make of it what you will, but that's a fact. I was in it last week. There was a dinner for the British Irish Parliamentary Assembly, and I was showing my Irish colleagues from the Irish Parliament this portrait. So Britain is amazingly flexible. You can be an assassin, carve up our politicians, and the chief secretary who was carved up. A relative of Gladstone's brought in to replace Forster, who had been the previous chief secretary, who believed the concessions made to Parnell in the final settlement of the Camillian Treaty were too great. Parnell himself may well have, and I can't prove this, but there is some evidence, certainly nationalists boasted it, the day before the assassination, met with Patrick Sheridan and reassured him that he wasn't about to sell out. So what you have to realize, this world of Dublin politics is not big. It's not massive. So, you know, it's small scale. And there was a revolutionary wing, and the revolutionary wing were serious enough about it. And some of the money that came, Parnell used to say money was often wasted by hardworking Irish American miners or rich farmers who didn't fight hard enough against the landlords. That was one of his favorite lines. But some of the money that came from hardworking Irish Americans went to fund assassination and bombing in London. No question about that. And that's what happens then in 1882 with the Phoenix Park murders. And Parnell, the trouble is Gladstone's already made the deal. You're locked in. And you cannot afford to think. Gladstone lucked out. Parnell was essentially conservative and moderate. That was a real part of his personality. But that's almost an accident. Once he's decided to make a deal in the Camillian Treaty, once he's decided that I'm a British liberal, I can't, for example, lock people up without trial, perfectly reasonable, understandable thing for a liberal to say. I've lectured other countries all over Europe for doing this. Once you've made that decision, you have to believe that your gamble on a compromise with Parnell will stick. And that is why British political elite do not like to pay attention to the fact that they actually made a deal with assassins as well. And I mean, Parnell wanted to get away from that world as quick as he could. Gladstone lucked out. But the reality is that the deal had an underside to it, which is, to say the least, morally dubious, but inevitable. There's no alternative.
How did Parnell react to Gladstone's declaration of supporting Home Rule in late 1885?
Well, he was pleased, but he wanted the Conservatives to do it instead. And he came halfway close to getting the Conservatives to do it. Winston Churchill's father, Randolph Churchill, was very much leading that way, at least in 1885. He then changes his mind. But it's perfectly obvious that Parnell wanted the Conservatives rather than the Liberals to do it. And there's a purely practical reason. As I mentioned earlier, the House of Lords had a political power in those days. It does not have today. And therefore, the House of Lords could block a bill that passed the House of Commons, as eventually it did in the case of the Home Rule Bill in 1893. They had the power to block it. So there's a purely tactical reason why Parnell wanted the Tories rather than the Liberals to embrace it. Purely tactical and perfectly sound reason. But it wasn't just because of the House of Lords. It's perfectly clear that every year that passes from the May 1882 assassinations, Parnell shudders more and says, my God, I was close to these crazy people. I'm not going back there. Mad assassins. These were some of my friends. I mean, Dadso might choose to deceive himself about that. Parnell wouldn't. And every year that happens, every private conversation is politically more and more emotionally conservative. It's time to switch this stuff off in Ireland. Yes, we must have a parliament in Dublin, but it should be as conservative and capitalist as possible. That's the way he's thinking. Absolutely the way he's thinking. And so he was pleased. Yes, you've got one of the major parties of the state now in favor of home rule. But actually, because it becomes a dividing issue, and the Conservatives take the other side, and of course, on the whole, politically and electorally for the next 20 years in England, that worked for the Conservative Party. But that's not what Parnell wanted. Parnell wanted to see, in an ideal world, you take what you can get. It's a huge achievement. When he went into Parliament in 1875, nobody thought anywhere that 10 years from now, a British Prime Minister will do as Mr. Gladstone did in May 1886 and introduce a Home Rule Bill. Nobody thought that would happen. That's Parnell's huge achievement. It's a product of the Land League. It's a product of the electoral successes. But, you know, sometimes when a thing happens, we all say, yeah, that was going to happen. Well, maybe so, but no wise man in 1875 said within 10 years, British Prime Minister will be in favour of Home Rule and setting up a Dublin Parliament again. So that's, you know, to answer your original question, he was pleased, but he would have preferred it to be the Conservative Party.
Would you agree with Parnell's wife that Parnell was, quote, not Irish at all, unquote?
Well, it's interesting that she says this. And she describes his habits. And a lot of his habits are classically of an English educated man of his age. One's not particularly interested in literature. He could be got to read Dickens. But so in a literary or historical sense, would read the odd literary historical book, but very interested in science, which was absolutely not the thing. Irish Catholics tended to regard science, especially as Darwin became more popular, as essentially a challenge to the religion, something he wasn't know about. And Dillon, by the way, would be an exception to this. Dillon and his wife, because they're extremely well-educated, were well aware of all the possible sophisticated reconciliations you could make between religion and Darwinism. But the ordinary Irish MP would just regard this as godlessness, the type of science that people like Professor Tyndall, his wife discusses his reading, was extremely interested in. So there's an intellectual style which is cool, clinical, scientific. I point out somewhere that when he was asked to do an account of 100 to contribute to a magazine which was running a session on what's the most important books to you, he couldn't be bothered. And other people recommended his grandfather's books on Catholic emancipation and so on. He said he couldn't really think of anything, and his opinion wouldn't be worth anything. So in that sense, he's not saturated in Irish culture. Gaelic language, no interest whatsoever. None whatsoever, right? On the other hand, she describes him, his wife, of being addicted to, when he was ill or had accidents, being addicted to the local peasant cures. Irish folk culture, you know, what you do with if this or that happens to you, you've got an infection in your hand or something. So, you know, that's it. This is a boy brought up in Wicklow and who would mix with a local peasantry and once working for his family. And he says that she says he was very loyal to the old housemaid, Susan Gaffney, was always telling her stories. So it's a mixture. It's a mixture. And he definitely had this acute sense of family pride that the Parnells of Wicklow were people of substance. And, you know, broadly speaking, that's true. His father being, you know, nondescript in terms of public life. But apart from that, there was a long tradition of people at a senior level and impressive politics in the first half of the 19th century, that they were people of substance. And a lot of English members of Parliament say they felt that his resentment to England was that somehow the English failed to realise that he was a Parnell of Wicklow, and that was a big deal. And one English MP writes in his diaries, he says he was a man of intense family pride. He thought we didn't know where the Parnells of Wicklow were. We didn't really, but who can blame us? You know, but that's it. Family, Irish family pride, Anglo-Irish family pride, absolutely what made him tick. And he would teach the English that they were, you know, Parnells of Wicklow were a serious people. And he did. He did teach them. You know, that 10 years he runs that, you know, he's a key figure in the Parliament the whole time.
What role in Irish politics in the post-Parnellian period did Dillon play?
Well, that's an interesting question. I used to be very critical of him, as a lot of people did, because when it came to the great Wyndham Land Act reform of 1903, when it came to that, John Redmond, who was then the official chairman of the Irish Parliamentary Party, and I've read his letter, says, this is the moment Parnell always wanted. This was what was in his mind's eye. This is his heart's dream. And now he must build on that Land Act. Whereas Dillon says, oh no, it's still not to go far enough. There are still farmers who will benefit from this, and there are still landlords who will get away with their money. And he runs what's called the Swinford Revolt. That's after the town called Swinford in Mayo, which was Dillon's constituency, also where one of his family businesses were. And so he revolted against the Wyndham Land Act. The reason why that's significant is Redmond basically, who had also been at Trinity College like Dillon's father, but didn't hate it like Dillon did. John Redmond said, this is the moment. And you would expect this. Redmond had a Protestant mother, Catholic father. He says, this is it. Land was the big divisive issue between Catholic, Protestant, and Ireland. It's over. British Parliament has now finally done what Parnell says it should do. Finance the transition of ownership of one land of Ireland from the landlords to the peasantry and the tenantry. And this will lead to a new politics of reconciliation. This is the moment to bring landlords over to the popular side, to end these bitter grievances, these land wars, which has actually been characterized by many assassinations in the countryside. Put it all behind us. And Dillon says, no, don't put it all behind us. We must keep this going. Unless we keep resentment on this going, people will stop voting for the party. Not true, actually, but that's what he thought. And I, like a number of other historians, Dr. Philip Bull in Australia and so on, took the view that this was essentially Redmond was right, and this was a narrow-minded approach by Dillon, seizing the opportunity to, and people like Dr. Bull and myself, living during the bitter Catholic-Protestant troubles of the last part of last century, were always looking for moments when it might have been different. And so that's what we thought and said. And there is still an element of truth in that. It's very difficult not to sympathize with Redmond at some level. The fact is that in this book, I've taken more time to construct the way that Dillon thought about things, to look at his other achievements. And I think it would basically would have been impossible for him to have taken a softer approach. And I now think there are other great achievements to his name, like which I tended to ignore, like the Irish structure of higher education in Dublin today essentially flows from the reforms that Dillon brought about in 1909. So I'm not, and I also think that when it came to the really bitter conflict, the Home Rule crisis, and with Eva Carson on the other side, and despite bitter exchanges, Dillon never believed in coercing the Protestant North. You know, then that, and was one of the first nationalist MPs to say, our whole story is being we don't want to be coerced by the British. We can't then turn around and coerce the minority on the island of Ireland on a matter of political allegiance. So it's, you know, it's very difficult to say that, as I tended to do, this is a man who was stuck in a old-fashioned anti-Protestant nationalist mode. There's a bit of that in Dillon, but he did, in the last great crisis of Home Rule and the rise of Sinn Féin, he's always saying, we cannot coerce the Ulster unionists. We may totally disagree with them, we totally hate their politics, but and their fears are totally exaggerated, but we cannot use weapons of coercion against them, because we ourselves have resisted weapons of coercion against us by the British state. So that's quite impressive in a way, quite impressive. You can tell that I've softened to Dillon. If you look at my books over a 30-year period, you can see that the judgments become less harsh.
How did Dillon react to the Easter Uprising of 1916?
Well, like everybody else, he was caught on, he didn't expect it. Now, he reacted very well in the sense that he condemned the British repression. What he doesn't do, and this is what we could do in London, the Rising was launched in alliance with the Germans. The leaders of the Rising were quite explicit about this. They put up a big post saying, our gallant allies, you know, will come to our support. Germans didn't, actually. But Dillon, who had supported the war against Germany on the grounds that, you know, fundamentally it wasn't a liberal democracy and was an authoritarian regime which threatened, for example, Catholic Belgium. Dillon forgets all that. And so he makes a speech which is widely admired by, in Ireland, saying, you know, against the executions, against the British repression of the Rising. And indisputably, I think the Irish historians who say that the obvious point about British repression, it was just enough to infuriate, not enough to intimidate, which is always a danger. And certainly they fell into the trap in 1916. So he makes a speech, which everybody says is great, in Dublin. In London, people say, hold on a minute, this was a, you supported the war against the Germans, and these people are allied to the Germans, and you remain silent about that, literally silent. So it's a mixed story about how people perceive the speech. Anyway, it didn't save his reputation. The tide went much more nationalist, much more green, and he lost his seat within 2 years.
Why did Dillon not approve of the Irish Free State?
Well, there again, this is the other side of Dillon. It surprised me. So when I was going through his correspondence, I found a correspondence with Horace Plunkett. Now, Horace Plunkett was one of those reformist Irish landlords who, at the time of the Wyndham Land Act, was taking the same view as John Redmond. This is great. The land question is going to be solved. Everybody's going to have enough money to get by. Let's have a new relationship between the classes in Ireland. And Horace Plunkett was, could easily be seen as some kind of soft nationalist. Dillon says, bugger off, I hate you. You're the black spawn of Cromwell. And by the way, Plunkett was indeed from a family who come up with Cromwell. All the brutality, which is real, associated with Cromwell's name. Dillon says, no, I can't do it. I can't be having it. I don't want to be reconciled with you. Doesn't matter how benign this piece of legislation is. 20 years later, I discover him writing in his correspondence, these warm letters with Plunkett. And Dylan, this is the other, I mentioned how well educated Dylan was, that he read science and so on. Plunkett was also extremely interested in science. And Dylan had, for example, great commitment to the Irish language as well. His son, Miles Dylan, was the greatest Celtic scholar produced in 20th century Ireland, a great professor. And his grandsons are professors in Berkeley, I think, certainly on the West Coast. He very academic. But he also did not believe, while his family were deeply committed to the Irish language, his son turned out to be the greatest scholar of the 20th century in the Irish language, does not believe in the use of coercion against Protestants to make them learn it. So there's this liberal streak, and the liberal streak, which is always there somewhere, this man is reading all the time. Parnell didn't read that much books, except science books. Dylan read everything. People visit his house, they can't get into his study for the books lying around everywhere. And the liberal streak becomes more and more pronounced. So by 1909, Dylan is warning the Gaelic League, Irish language is great, don't be unfair to the Protestant boy. They ignore him. Right? It's got to be compulsory. You know, the Protestants are going to be very keen on the language, and most likely for jobs requiring the language, they'll then go to England. So there's this liberacy becomes more important. So he's writing to Plunkett, his old enemy, whom he would not reconcile with in 20 years earlier. And Plunkett says things like, I just can't believe how anybody can sustain old historical, what's my phrase, ancestral voices type grievances. How anybody can sustain this over this length of time. The world has changed. It's the 20th century. We're all civilized, etc. 20 years later, Dylan and Plunkett now are friends at last. And Dylan says to him, Plunkett writes to him and says, I just can't believe what the modern Ireland is like. It's turning its back on the modern world, on science. No money is going from the new government to science in Dublin at all. On the other hand, piles and piles of money is going to county councils to have compulsory Irish. Something which actually failed within its own terms. But that's where the money and resources are going. And Dylan writes back and says, I couldn't agree with you more. And that's why Dylan says, then finally in 1925, he gets up and he says, I used to complain about British oppression and bad government. Nothing could be worse than the government we have from our own people now. And that's the thing, with people hugely embarrassed, all his old friends. But Dylan, but there is this side of him, intellectual, concerned about science, concerned about the maintenance of Ireland's scientific tradition, which is quite substantial in the 19th century, both Catholic and Protestant and the elites. That's a side of him. This is a man who is a real, intellectual, very bookish figure in politics. And that's why he says this most amazing thing. In 1925, a major speech saying, if we could get the oppression we had back from the British, I prefer to have that than what we have now from our own native Irish government. And in the broad context, you've got to remember, when he dies in 1927, look, it was already clear that in terms of material growth, Ireland was not going to win out of independence. Now, we're in a different period moment now in the last generation. But up until that point, that was a perfectly reasonable argument. In purely economic terms, this is not really work. Emotional satisfaction, big time works. Self-importance, big time works. But now, it's only in the last 30 years you can say it as well as emotional satisfaction. You have economic success with self-government.
Lord Bew, if you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
That ancestral voices are important, as they were to both these men, Parnell believing he came from a former Protestant tradition and trying to put that into practice, and in Dylan believing he came from a highly educated Catholic tradition, and no man was superior to him. And he wouldn't tolerate any hint of that. And that's why he disliked Trinity College in Dublin, but who nonetheless was loyal to his intellectual convictions, the results of his reading, and was not prepared to say, in the end, comforting things to his political allies if he believed something was true. So it's a story, really, of the complexity of human beings and how they battle with inheritances and grievances from the past and cultural tropes from the past, and how, nonetheless, they actually make something of it and remake it again and again in every generation in a complicated and interesting way.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Lord Bew, for being so kind to speak with us today. This is Charles.
Thank you, Dr. Coutinho.
Thank you, Lord Bew. This is Charles Coutinho. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. Thank you, Lord Bew, very much.